Welcome to this episode of Bush and Banner, hosted by me, Jennifer Mabus, and Diana Carmella. I am so excited about our guest today. This is stuff that is right up my alley. I have so much respect for these kinds of individuals, and I don't know him personally, but just reading about him online, I am so impressed with him. But Diana, you actually know him. That's how we made this contact.
Yeah, in 2016, I had the honor, I was distinguishedly picked to fly to Alaska, and I got to hang out with the military, with the Air Force. I met this individual. He was a pararescue man. He was getting ready to retire and just blew me away. They did a whole demonstration with the plane flying by, and they had pararescue men jump out. Yeah, I met him and thought to myself, he's the perfect guest because he is like definitely cooler than us by far.
Just top-notch individual.
And top-notch individual.
I don't think many of you know this, but it actually, that trip and Chief Bear is what Diana calls him. Chief Bear inspired Diana to become like G.I. Jane, and Diana actually shaved her head.
Oh, gosh. Right. I wish that was true. Our guest today really enlightened me to pararescue men and their jobs and their wild lives that these guys live.
Their motto essentially is that they risk their lives to save others. So a pararescue man is just one of the most brave, in my opinion, noble, just respectable professions out there.
Pararescue men, these are the guys where if you get stuck, if you break a leg on top of a mountain or you're in the middle of the ocean and your boat capsizes, these are the guys that show up in a plane or a helicopter, jump out and get down to you. And essentially, they are literally willing to risk everything to get you out as safe as possible. They have to be trained in combat. They have to be trained as a skilled medic. They have to have so many skills. And so, yeah, I'm super interested to hear about the training and what goes into being a pararescue man.
As of today, there are no women PJs. And so this is a calling to all you young females out there that you can do it. Diana and I are too old and too washed up. We already talked about it. So any other young woman listening, you can
do it. I'm in the prime of my life right now.
I don't know what's harder, being a PJ or delivering two babies with no medication. I don't know. But, with that, folks, Diana, who is on the program?
Our guest today enlisted in the Alaska National Air Guard back in the year 2000 and has since emerged as one of the most distinguished and recognizable pararescue men in Alaska's wilderness rescue community. With an impressive track record, he's directly responsible for saving 106 lives and providing assistance to an additional 43 survivors across 91 challenging rescue missions in Alaska. Moreover, his expertise extends beyond Alaskan borders, having been deployed worldwide for combat rescue missions and humanitarian aid efforts. These days, he's sharing his wealth of experience as a heli-ski guide, leading adventurous backcountry skiers through some of Alaska's most remote and wild mountain ranges. It is such an honor to welcome to the program Paul Berendrecht, better known as Bear. We really appreciate you doing this. You are such a busy guy, it sounds like. So,
it sounds like you have a lot on your plate. So before we get started, we like to ask all of our guests, where are you recording from?
So I am in Girdwood, Alaska right now, our ski condo, getting ready to go skiing after this, a little spring skiing. So I'm in a bedroom. It's the most quiet place on the mountain, so.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah.
What a life.
I know. What a life. Yeah. Do you remember my group from 2016?
I do. Yeah. You were a bunch of people from Hollywood and coming up and visiting the base. And if I remember, a bunch of media people, right? So maybe not Hollywood, but a bunch of media people from all over, I think centrally located in LA.
Wow. You remember it better than I do.
Yeah, I mean, you guys were a big group and it was pretty fun. And I remember we kind of took you around and had you get on the aircraft and watch jumps and helicopter stuff. And yeah, I remember you guys.
I got to tell you just a really fast story. So I got put on that trip 48 hours before the trip. I got a call, and it's the funniest thing, because one of my friends was supposed to be on the trip and he canceled, and he put my name in. So 48 hours before we were going to leave Riverside, California, I get a call, and it was a lieutenant of some sort. I don't remember his name, but he said, you know, would you like to fly to Alaska in 2 days? And I was like, absolutely.
Yeah, who doesn't?
Like, without a doubt. But then I thought it was like a, it was a scam. And so then I was like asking him all these questions, and I was like, this can't be real. And he goes, just be at this location, you know, in 2 days. And I show up to the location. It was the Air Force Base in Riverside. And I pull up to the guard gate and I give him my name. I was like, I'm Diana Carmella. And he goes, okay, we need you to go to that building straight ahead. And there was nobody around. And I'm like,
Oh
this
my
is
gosh.
definitely a scam. And then
Right.
I'm walking, and then I park my car. And then you know what I think to myself? I think to myself, what if the military needs my help with
Oh,
something?
please.
No.
That's right. Like
Like,
secret agent, you know. I mean,
yeah. And
Demi Moore, Navy SEALs. You haven't gone through the training yet, but I can see it. I see it all happening.
I'm very mediocre at most things. So I was like, what could they possibly need my help with? But I am here to serve. And then I walk into the building and it's like 30 industry people, and I was like, oh no,
Right.
it's actually true. But I remember you and the whole PJ show you guys gave us with the guys jumping out of the planes. It was so memorable, and I still to this day tell this story about what I saw, because it was something I never experienced before. And so
Right.
I guess our first question is, you know, how did you kind of get started in this? Like, where are you originally from, and how did you land in Alaska, kind of getting
Oh
into that
gosh.
world? That's a loaded question.
That is a very loaded question. I'd like to say it was very well thought out and I had a plan and I executed my plan. So I grew up in, but that's not the case. I grew up in Southern California, Orange County area, born in Newport Beach, raised in Fullerton. And I joined the military at 17. I had to get my parents' signature, which they were very happy to provide to go in. I was, you know, a bit of a loose cannon as a kid. I left myself without options. My parents were both immigrants from the Netherlands, and so they had that European tough love, said, you know, you can stay here, but you're going to have to pay rent. You can go to college. You'll have to pay tuition, or you can do whatever you want. And you know, I took the ASVAB test, which is the military like vocational aptitude test, to get out of class. I would speed through it, and then I would cut the rest of the day from school because you would take it during like first. You were supposed to take it all day, but I took it in like the first and second period, and then left for the rest of the day. So I was in the military system and was called by recruiters and thought, oh, you know, maybe I'll do that. I'll get some money for college. I'm a little bit out of options right now. So I'll join up. The Air Force sounds cool because, you know, maybe I'll be a pilot or something, you know, just not knowing anything. Like
Yeah.
this was not a patriotic move. This wasn't a anything kind of move like, oh, I've got this lifelong fantasy. It was just a yeah, let's go do this. I mean, this sounds good. So I end up going to join the Air Force, you know, after the summer, after my high school senior year. I was a young graduate. So like I said, 17, had to get my parents' signature and then joined basic training. I went open general, zero plan again. Just went in like, all right, well, eyes wide open. What's out there? Let's see what I'll do. Find out about pararescue on the fourth day. This was 1992, so we still had slide decks where, you know, they click it and it drops a slide in, shows your picture. And so this PJ got up and did a briefing and said, hey, here's this super cool job. You're probably not going to make it, you know, showing people jumping out of airplanes, scuba diving, doing all this stuff. You know, 9 out of 10 people fail. But if you want to, here's a tryout, you know, to try out. And so you go and you do this simple physical test. And you run, you swim, you do some calisthenics, and then you are allowed to enter into the selection course after basic training. So went through that, started with 120 something, ended up with 8 people through, you know, through the selection course. And then you go through what's called the pipeline, which is basically the DoD's best schools. You go to jump school, dive school, free fall school, you know, advanced parachuting, like skydiving, but with a bunch of equipment on, survival, water survival, and then helicopter egress, underwater egress. And then you go to pararescue school to finish out with medical training, small unit training, advanced parachuting, and some survival stuff and field stuff as well. And so that was, I graduated, became a PJ. My first assignment was Cocoa Beach, Florida. Spent a couple years there, a couple of deployments, went up to Iceland, was stationed at Keflavik Air Base, Iceland, and then Kadena Air Base, Okinawa, and then came up to Alaska in 2000. I joined the Air National Guard, which is the National Guard component of the Air Force, where I stayed until I retired in 2017, in February 2017. So that was the, you know, the ad hoc. I think I never intended to be a lifer. I never intended to stick around too long. It was always, oh, this is still pretty fun. I'll do this a little bit more. I'll do this a little bit more. You're working with people that, you know, are like-minded, motivated individuals who also have an extremely awesome sense of humor and personality, like big personalities, big, big humor. Yeah. And so it was just enough to keep me going, keep me going. And then 24 and a half years later, I decided to finally hang it up because it was, you know, that was the deal.
Yeah.
That's a long list of responsibilities.
way too much responsibility.
It's a lot. So a little background. My husband's actually in the Navy. He's a deep sea diver.
Okay.
But he always says if he could go back in time, he would join the Air Force. An attempt to, you know, become a PJ. Same kind of situation. He just was like, oh, what's cool? You know, I'm just going
right.
to join the Navy and I'm going to do this hard thing. And my dad right. Is a former Green Beret. So I've got all of this world.
Right.
So being in, and I've worked for the Department of Defense since I graduated college. So, you know, I'm very familiar with this world and we're all interested in to know what your training was like. You said 1992. So what was the training like then? I mean, I know you listed all the schools. And how do you think it compares today for people who are joining and going through the same things you did in 1992? Has it changed much or?
I would say there are minor changes, but everybody's still cut from the same cloth. And, you know, the person is the same. The training has gotten even better. They're more professional now than they were when I came in. You know, when I, in 1992, we still had Vietnam guys in who were awesome and huge mentors. Then there was the Cold War, and the equipment was old and tired and the tactics were old and tired. They were still, you know, they still had amazing people, but the training was the same as it had been for a while and hadn't, you know, had seen some updates, but not. You know, not the way that it is now where, you know, the people I see that were coming up behind me were trained way better mm-hmm. than I was trained and expected to do a whole lot more than I was expected to do. You know, I feel like I sipped from the water fountain and they're being forced to drink from the fire hose. Mm-hmm. You know, I got just a little bit of training over time. So I was able to digest it and, you know, put it to where it needed to be in a way that the young people coming in now are like, okay, ready, set, 100 miles an hour, yeah. go. And I think they are coming in with more knowledge. There was no internet back then. And so you couldn't research how to train. You know, I was not like a physical stud when I was young. I was active. I, you know, swam, I surfed and, you know, played sports, whatever. But I wouldn't say I was a specimen, neither would my mom. And so, you know, that tough love. But when you're out of options and you're stubborn, then you just sort of gut it out and you make it through the training, the initial training that selects you. When they say, all right, you can quit now and we'll go eat steak and lobster on my credit card. if just give me one quitter, and nobody would quit, and then at the end somebody would quit, and we'd say, why didn't you do that at the beginning of the training session? We would have gotten steak and lobster. And so what I would say is it's they're more professional and more well trained now than they ever were. Now there's a name for pararescue out there in a way that it was in a lull when I came in,
Okay.
is what I would say. Yeah, if that makes
Yeah.
sense.
With your training, do you recall something being more difficult than the other sessions where you almost were like, this is what's going to make me quit?
Yeah, I think the pool is the great
I've
equalizer
heard this, yeah.
for everybody. I think, if you were to ask to a person, most people would say the pool was the biggest challenge. When you're doing water confidence training specifically, where you are doing drills that are made to make you hypoxic and take away a couple of breaths, where you expel a breath to catch a breath, except that then they're splashing water in your face or dunking you just as you're trying to take a breath, and you've just got to suck it up and keep your cool and wait for the next opportunity to catch a breath. Take care of your buddy and wait for your next opportunity. And hopefully that person is taking care of you and making sure that you get your breath, if that makes
Yeah.
sense.
Oof. I'm not a water person. I can barely swim, so we're not water people, and we don't like planes very much. We always gotta tell people
This
that.
might not be the job for you
Yeah. I'm gonna
then.
leave it to you, sir. So, can you do
Fair
me a
enough.
favor? I'm gonna be very honest. When I went to Alaska, that was really the first time I was introduced to PJs and their responsibilities and who they are and their sole purpose. Can you just tell our listeners, for who are not familiar with the job, what are some responsibilities of PJs?
Yeah, you bet. Pararescue's primary job is combat search and rescue. And that's, anyone, anywhere, anytime, day, night, mountains, water, combat, non-combat. It's just combat search and rescue is the overarching thing, or personal recovery is also, a nom de guerre. But it's, we're out there, we're all trained medics, paramedics. Some have more qualifications as well. And, the primary job is to go in and save down air crew, or, save other services out of combat, and also recover people or objects, from austere environments as well. And, we work either in small teams off of any kind of platform. So we can either parachute in, or we can ride a helicopter in, or we've got all-terrain vehicles, or we'll dive or take boats. There's a lot, we have, access to any kind of way to get in. There's been people in Alaska that have taken trains, those funny train cars that drive on train tracks, to get to a mission because the weather was so bad.
Wow.
We, ride snowmobiles. Basically, I would say, to put it succinctly, is we're the people behind the glass. So if you need to, like, as the last resort, then that's your PJ going to make it happen. Sometimes we'll be attached to other special forces teams, Army Special Forces or the Navy or the Marines, and work alongside of them or with them as a force multiplier. So we take care of the rescue portion of a technical rescue, or the medicine if they don't have a medic attached to them, or we augment their medical component.
That's a lot.
It's a
It
lot.
is a lot. I'm curious, when an emergency call comes in, can you guide us through like the standard protocol for how you would respond to the situation?
So we would get, the 5 W's, or, here's the situation. So this is what's going on. We have a person in the backcountry who has a femur fracture, and the weather looks like this. We can fly the helicopter there. So we say, okay, what gear do we think we need for this mission? We have these, in Alaska, we have these carts with all of our equipment on it, where you would have scuba gear, you would have rock climbing gear, you would have cold weather gear, parachuting gear, all on a push cart that you would wheel out to an awaiting truck to either take you to a C-130 to go parachute into an incident, or to a helicopter to fly directly and either land near them or hoist into them, you know, ride a steel cable down to them, or any other manner of getting to the person. And then you get there. However, again, it could be aircraft or it could be over ground or over water, and you show up and, you know, make contact with them and start to take care of them if they need medical treatment. Sometimes it's just supportive care. Sometimes it's, you know, splinting or stopping the bleeding. And then you're working on a plan to get them out of there as well, because getting there is just one aspect of it. Getting out can be a different thing. And then bring them back to higher level of medical care, or at least over to a higher authority.
Wow. That was one thing I remembered on that trip when I think we were in the, my terminology is going to be really bad right now, like the bunkhouse of the F-16 pilots, like the fighter plane pilots. We're in the bunkhouse and they were explaining to us, like, if an emergency happens, they have, I think it was 4 minutes to whatever they're doing, get in a plane and get the plane in the air. And this one gentleman said he was like in the shower when he got the call, and he came out and he wrapped a towel around him, and then he had to get in the plane. So he's in the plane with a towel around him. And I think they like threw him a jacket or something. And I was like, oh my, you have to be ready like that to go when the call comes in.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, your work in Alaska, you did a bunch of work around Denali. Was that right?
Yep. We have augmented the National Park Service to do high altitude rescues off of Denali as well. We see it as training. They see it as, you know, strong backs and medical care and, you know, expertise. And it's, you know, it's all towards the higher cause of search and rescue and refining our craft and refining our skills.
I'm curious because I've lived in many different places, and oftentimes where I live, there's local search and rescue groups. Mm-hmm. Would you work with those groups, or if your presence was in the area, would those groups not exist?
Sometimes, yes and yes, I would say is the answer. You know, we would leave it to the civilian organizations because they're highly capable, they're highly trained as well. And then if they needed to break the glass, then we were there to assist as needed and to help them out. Or if they didn't have the resources, whether it be, you know, distance where they couldn't fly a helicopter to this location, or they couldn't get one of the teams in, you know, most of the acreage in Alaska, which is 1/5 the size of the continental United States, most of that is off the road system. So you're not driving to any of these things. There's, you know, Alaska is a big state, and there are local search and rescue teams, but when it gets overwhelming, or when the weather doesn't allow them, or nighttime, you know, some civilian organizations are limited by night operations through no fault of their own, but we have, you know, our nation, the world's best technology at our disposal as well, where we can parachute in with night vision goggles, get picked up by a helicopter that's doing mid-air refueling to come get us, and then be plucked off of a mountainside all in one thing. And it's just another day of training for us, or it's just it's another complex problem-solving mission that we are used to. Yeah, and it sounds almost, you know, surreal, and it's hard because on one level you want to be humble and the quiet professional, and then on the other hand nobody's ever heard of you, and so you have to explain what's going on, or what you're capable of, or what the team that is standing by is capable of. You know, when I retired as a chief master sergeant, which is the highest enlisted rank. And it was my job to advocate for all of these quiet professionals and sit there and sing their praises and, you know, talk about the amazing things they do. And they're like, oh, shucks, Bear, can you not say that? Because it sounds like we're bragging. And yeah, it does, except that you're just talking about what you do for a living.
But what you do for a living is incredible. Diana and I are just trying to figure out if being a PJ is in our future.
Yeah, totally.
Listen, I want to serve, and I do really well under stressful situations.
There you go.
I just got to get through the, the flight thing.
There's the planes, there's the water, you know. Just
no big deal.
Just a couple of inconveniences.
No big deal.
No, no big deal.
I am curious, are there today any women that are PJs?
There are not any women that I know of. 2016 is when Congress authorized the, you know, the sort of final wall to women in the military was broken down, the final barrier, and allowed into, you know, the special operations world. And to date, I don't know that there are any women who are pararescuemen, pararescue.
Yes. Diana, this is our calling. We're scared, we're old, but you know,
that's right. Yep, you just got to be, you know, out of options, I think was how I did
really desperate.
I recommend desperation as a motivator.
I'm very very fit. I'm abnormally strong for a girl, and I'm fast, and so
go.
I do really well under stressful situations. But can you tell us about a like a mission like that you're very proud of?
Yeah, sure. So there was in 2012 in Afghanistan, we were on Bastion Air Base, which was in the Helmand province, and a very busy deployment. We, you know, were doing multiple rescues a day. We were working on small teams. We were also going in and getting people out of, you know, active firefights and just doing a lot and staying super busy. And that's kind of the personality that is drawn to this job. You know, we're Labradors for rescue, and you know, rescue is the stick, and all we want to do is have the stick thrown for us and go do these rescues. You know, we need to be on our best day when people are having their worst day is sort of the line, right? It's so cliche, but it's totally true. And you know, one of the missions that I was involved in was totally spontaneous and completely outside of the box. We had 11 insurgents get into the wire and just start wreaking havoc on base. And so myself and three other guys drove across the base in the dead of night. You know, they were shooting rockets at aircraft and burning down aircraft, Harrier jets. And this is September 14th, 15th in the Helmand province at Bastion Air Base. And not a lot of press was going on about it, but we ended up going and attaching to a UK airfield defense team and moving and getting some people out of some situations and, you know, going after the insurgents and helping suppress the threat and all, you know, off the couch, essentially. Like, we were just hanging out and on standby, not even on call for anything that was going on, and then responded to it and driving, you know, across the base while helicopters are shooting overhead. And, you know, just like in the end, the team performed really well for an asymmetrical operation, you know, that wasn't in any playbook, but it was just a series of small problems. And we had to not only worry about the insurgents, but they were inside the wire. So we also had to worry about our own people shooting at us, our, you know, fratricide, because everybody was scared because they didn't know these insurgents were in army uniforms as well. So it just made it very, very interesting and challenging. And we, you know, broke it down into little bite-sized bits and took care of it. And I think I'm pretty proud of that. I'm also pretty proud of the way that deployment went, where, you know, every call that we got, we answered and performed really well, you know, in some pretty dire situations.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty cool.
That's just terrifying. And there's so many levels. You said that happened, what year was that?
2012,
you said, in September. I mean, I mean, I don't remember reading anything about that.
No.
In the news,
There was no press. A couple of generals were fired after the fact because, you know, these people had gotten through this isolated base out in the middle of nowhere. They had gotten through the wire. And so it was a bit of a black eye on the base. But, you know, that's, it was.
And Yeah, it what comes to mind is you needing to trust your team and the people you work with and alongside, you know, the people who work alongside you. Like you said, you know, you didn't know, you know, it was probably chaos in a lot of ways. Yeah, you don't know who's if someone's shooting at you, yeah. Like who it is, and yeah, just needing to have that we'll say brotherhood or that bond, you know, and really trusting one another. And so I'm also mm-hmm. curious, if you have a mission that stands out as being the most difficult, whether it was the duration or the weather or how to get, you know, to the place you needed to get, is there one that really was,
oh gosh,
was extremely difficult?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of the ones that maybe scared me the most was when I was stationed in Iceland and we had a sick fisherman about 300 miles out to sea. And we were, and it was 40-foot seas. We fly out to go get this person. It's nighttime. The boat is just tossing all over the place. We unfortunately weren't able to get down to the boat because it was so bad. And the ceilings were 100 feet above the water and going all the way up to about 10,000 feet. So there was this cloud deck that was really solid. You know, it's the North Atlantic. Our anti-icing on the helicopter wasn't working. So we had to fly super high or super low above the water. That wasn't completely the problem. The problem was on our way back, we're 300 miles out to sea and we go to do an aerial refueling because that's what the HH-60 Payhawks are capable of with 300 miles to go. And we couldn't get gas. And we, you know, start problem solving. We couldn't get gas. I'm starting to hand out my extra survival gear because I think we're going to ditch in the middle of the North Atlantic, you know, 300 miles out to sea in 40-foot waves. And it was, it was a mental challenge to have to turn back on a mission and not complete the mission. You know, here we are, the Labrador coming back without the stick. And we, you know, it's really hard to feel like you're failing because you're not accomplishing the complete task, although it would have been an impossible feat. You know, I was sitting there trying to talk them into letting me jump in the water and swim over to this boat or the ship in 40-foot seas, which in hindsight, you know, was ridiculous, but I was, you know, 20 years old and full of, you know, vim and vinegar. And so I thought I could do that. Thankfully, the aircraft commander talked me out of that. And then, you know, so the mental letdown of that was difficult and long. And then almost running out of gas on the way back was also just this mental task that was really difficult. And we finally end up doing some non-standard procedures. And finally, after about half an hour, and the gas in these helicopters are measured with these little lights that look like little chiclets. And so, you know, full looks like a lot of green, then you start getting lower and it gets yellow. And we had, you know, about one chiclet, red chiclet left of gas on the fuel gauge, and finally plug in, you know, at 10,000 feet, which is also pretty difficult for a helicopter because of all the different things. But then we started getting gas and everybody just started hooting and hollering in the back of this helicopter. And
I can't even imagine. That sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah,
like
it was a nightmare.
Literal nightmare.
Yeah, and we didn't even have the person. It was just the act of going out and doing it. Like we weren't even doing any medicine, but just the task itself was difficult without a person. And so I would say that was one of the more difficult. You know, I think they're all difficult in certain ways, right? It's all, there's no page in a book that any rescue goes on. So you sort of, you're flipping through chapters and saying, well, this looks a little bit like this one and this looks a little bit like this one. And so maybe this is a little more familiar than unfamiliar.
Yeah. Oh man. Jen and I both are through hikers. And so, yeah, we always think, you know, when we're out there hiking, the only way out is up sometimes. And from a helicopter, yeah. What is for like normal civilians, what is a common reason why people have to get rescued? And how can this be prevented for people spending time like in the wilderness?
Great question. I think one of the common things is people don't anticipate the weather or themselves. You know, they're not realistic with their expectations of their team, themselves, or what the weather or the environment can do. And, you know, I think people also don't think about how they're going to get themselves out. You know, I probably, to a fault, am always thinking about what is the worst case scenario that I'm going to be involved in, and can I get myself out of that, or at least, you know, close enough. You know, a good enough plan, not a great plan, but all you need is a good enough plan. And I think the way that people can prevent that is to, you know, look at themselves seriously and take themselves seriously and say, you know, am I okay with this? Am I good with this? And am I okay if something goes wrong? You know, nobody expects to sprain an ankle on a thru hike. But what if that happens? Are you going to be okay to get yourself out of there? Have you even so much as done like a mental exercise? Because yeah, all it takes is a mental exercise. Like, oh, well, I'm carrying poles, and so I'll at least do a makeshift splint, and that will toughen me up and get me to a place where I can call for whatever or get to a trailhead. You know, there's so many scenarios. I think sometimes people just go in completely oblivious to what can possibly happen.
And to piggyback off of that, I know of people, or I've even read stories where weather was going bad, and but these people wanted to keep hiking, like by themselves or even with a group of people. But another aspect to think about is if something goes wrong and you call for help, those people now have to risk their lives to come rescue you. And so it's having the ability to think about your own self, and also what are the steps that are going to be taken to help me get out of this situation, and is it going to be putting other people's lives at risk too? So I think definitely educating ourselves on just like survival, there's more to it than just myself.
And is it circumstance or is it negligence, right? Like, you sprained your ankle. Is that, you know, that's not negligence. That's just something that happened because whatever. But if you go out and you're just ill prepared for the situation or the environment, well then, you know, now that goes in the category of negligence. And that's a little bit harder. The search and rescue teams are still going to respond because that's
Of
their duty
course.
and that's what they do, and would do it every single time, without hesitation. It's just a little bit easier to take when, you know, they go, we tried this, we tried this, we tried this, and then we finally hit the beacon and, you know, called you guys. You know, expect to self-rescue is the ideal, and then everything else after that is a series of decisions that you've made that have gotten you to this point.
I'm curious how, and maybe you apply it to, your activities now, but especially when you were doing these rescue missions, how you and your team were able to maintain focus and resilience in really high stressful scenarios.
Just repetition and training and trust in your teammates, being in, you know, doing the training with them all the time, and holding yourselves accountable and taking your training seriously. You know, you're always trying to train to as close as you can to 100% each time, because often the skills can deteriorate, right? Like the further you are away from the training that you just did, the more your skills start to deteriorate. So it's better to have them degrade from 100% than it is 75%, right? So you're always, every time you get an opportunity, you don't just, we would call it pencil whipping. You don't just pencil whip it. You know, you don't just like say, I did the training. You take yourself seriously. You go through it all. You get it committed to memory. You talk about it. You debrief it. You challenge ideas, and take yourself seriously. And then your skills start to degrade from there. You know, as opposed to, oh yeah, we'll go kind of through the motions and whatever. I don't really remember what I did last time. And now you're working off of, you know, garbage in, garbage out kind of formula.
Yeah, I mean, there's many professions today where you can pencil whip things, but you would really hope that those in, search and rescue and those sort of like doctors, you're hoping those are the people who are like, please tell me you know what you're doing. Please. Yeah. So it's definitely one of those professions where, there's no real slacking, no room for negligence or laziness. And that's why I just have so much respect for you. And
oh, gosh, thank you. You know, it's also trusting that the person next to you takes themselves as seriously as you do, right? Like exactly. That's the, you know, you're looking at them saying, hey, dude, I think I could have done this better. What do you think? Or I think you could have done this better. I think we didn't communicate very well doing this. What are your thoughts on that? And we used to spend a fair amount of time in the debrief and talking about that stuff and trying to have lessons learned, lessons delivered, you know, come out the other side. And let's do that. Let's redo it. Or, hey, stop the bad iteration. Let's talk about it and then redo it the right way so that we commit it to muscle memory. And that way we're working off of good data in.
Are you taking tips, Diana, for our future trainings?
He was like, you got to trust your teammate. And then I'm looking at you and I was like, yeah. Dang it, man.
Do you trust me? Do you trust me to have your back?
I mean, it depends what it is. It's like 50-50. Barrett, how do you think your experience as a pararescue man shaped your perspective on life?
Wow, good question. I think what it made me realize is to never take anything for granted, whether it's your health or the people around you. You know, life, like wings fall off of planes. I don't want to say that, but it's true. Like things just happen and, you know, helicopters fall out of the sky and rocks fall and, you know, people die. And that's just the way that is. It's a matter of going through the life, you know, being intentional about everything and, you know, not taking anything for granted. And I think that's the perspective that I've gained, which is, you know, life's pretty great. And when you look around, there's a lot of good things going on. And it's easy to focus on the negatives and forget about the positives. And so maintaining that perspective and realizing that every day is a gift and it is what you make of it. And there are downtimes, but you got to get back in there. And, you know, just like people die, even though you've done the best medical treatment or whatever, it, through no fault of your own, that just happens. And so, you know, again, it's taking those opportunities seriously, taking the people around you and holding them tight and your health, your own health.
Yeah. I want to ask, in outside of the, you know, the Air Force and the Air National Guard, have you used your trainings to help you and like your family, you know, overcome challenges that are unrelated to, you know, something as serious as a life rescue mission?
I've certainly been with my family when we've had, you know, situations that, you know, I've had to act. And, you know, funny, we were hiking in Arizona and my wife comes running up to me and she's like, there's a situation, there's this guy freaking out and he's attacking another guy and you need to get involved. And my wife's a very capable outdoors person as well. And so I go running up and she's expecting me to wrestle this guy to the ground and save the situation. And this guy was having a mental episode. And he was yelling at this other guy about the demons on his shirt and the devil. And I looked at the guy and my wife's thinking I'm going to wrestle, you know, this guy to the ground. And I go, hey, dude, take off your shirt and throw it away. And so he takes off his shirt and he throws it away. And the guy completely calms down and he just walks away and goes down to the parking lot. And he ends up, you know, like getting help and, you know, calling services. But it was a total de-escalation and, you know, it wasn't me coming in to save the day. It was me coming in and doing the least amount that I needed to do for the situation. Like, I don't want to wrestle anybody to the ground, especially not a total stranger. When I can come in and sort out the situation and take in a bunch of data and resolve it at the lowest level. And I think my wife actually said it. She's like, I didn't really realize what you do on the job, but that gave me perspective that you're always taking in all the data and breaking it down and, you know, problem solving all the time. And I think that, you know, as a family, my kids might tell you a little bit differently. They might have some other ideas about, you know, how I handled some situations. But they all know how to start a fire. They all know, how to dress and take care of themselves and do all of that. Although now they've totally thrown that away for fashion because they're teenagers plus, and so,
Of course.
fashion over function.
Oh, your biggest challenge is yet to come, teenagers.
That's right. Oh my gosh. Yeah, right. And my jokes aren't as funny and all those other things.
Do you have any daughters?
My youngest is my daughter. I have two boys and a daughter. And so it's boy, boy, girl. Unfortunately for the world, she's a lot like me. And unfortunately for me, she's a lot like me. And so good luck. Good luck.
Oh, maybe she'll be the first female
Maybe.
pararescue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, get out of my way, boys.
We just got to get through high school first.
You can do it. Well, okay, because you do have children. Are there, let's say three things or a few things that you think all like children and even us adults should know about regarding survival? You mentioned starting a fire.
Yes. So I think knowing how to dress for the environment and is imperative. And that means, looking at the weather forecast, like a lot of survival is done to the left of the situation, right? Like on the timeline. Like it's done well beforehand. It's knowing how to survive and dress for the environment, knowing how to start a fire, and then knowing how to signal for an emergency. I used to, as a joke, people would always ask me, well, what do you recommend? What's the one thing you would bring for search and rescue? And I say a deck of cards because you can start playing solitaire and guaranteed someone's going to walk up to you and tell you what your next move is, and then you're saved. And so what card you should play. So my daughter doesn't think that's as funny anymore as I thought it was, but
My
she's like, don't tell the deck of cards, Dad. Don't tell the deck of cards.
We're glad you
Yes. We love dad
did.
jokes,
There you so
go.
we appreciate
Yeah.
it.
All about it.
I was going to ask if you were familiar with who Jessie Krebs is.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like one of the top SEER instructors.
Okay. Yes.
We recently had her on our podcast. So, some of the things you're saying are aligning with some of the things she's saying,
Yeah, what
but
did she say? I haven't listened to any of her stuff. What were some of her recommendations?
her biggest thing was signaling. People don't know how to signal.
Right.
And she has a master class, which I saw on an airplane ride. And then I actually spent a week with her in the woods of Montana for a thing, a woman's retreat. And her biggest thing was trying to figure out the landscape and how you can signal to get help. But she was also saying people freak out and they start walking in all these directions and they get more lost. So it's important to figure out kind of where you are. And then she went through like
Right.
steps. But yeah, people immediately, what am I going to do for food? What am I going to do for water? Like you don't have
Right.
to eat for a few days and you'll be okay. Like
3 weeks. Yeah.
few
Yeah.
weeks.
Yeah. Usually it's the rule of threes, right? So it's 3 hours for the environment, it's 3 days for water, and 3 weeks for food is
Yeah.
the
Yeah.
general idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically she
Yeah.
was like, if you, we were asking her from a standpoint, if you were to get lost in the woods, her first thing she said
Yeah.
was to stop. Like, stop what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because all of us are like, oh, we need to do ooh, build a fire in this. But she said the first thing you need to do is stop and get your mind together. If you need to sit down and read a book, if you have a book on
Right.
you need to play
Right.
solitaire, bring your cards. Someone will come out of the woods
Yeah.
and let you know you made the wrong move or,
Right. Trailhead's right back here, and you should play the ace first, and then, yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, the same. But, we were also asking her just some essentials to bring, even if you're just going on a day hike, because we were bringing up, Diane and
Yeah.
I were bringing up scenarios where people have gotten caught overnight on a mountain thinking they were just going on a 2 hour, 3 hour day hike. And so, similar to what you were saying, is you need to prepare, in case you do get stuck. What's the weather like at night? Do you need to take any medications,
Right.
like life-threatening medications? You need to bring multiple, doses with you if you can. And just, things like that,
Yeah.
things that maybe people wouldn't naturally think about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, Alaska is famous for mercurial weather, right? Like it'll be sunny and you're on a mountain hike, and next thing you know, you're in a snowstorm, if you're not keeping your eyes out. And the difference between what you pack in the winter and what you pack in the summer is just a layer or two and a bunch of fuel, you know, on a trip. Like we would go on our sailboat and we would take basically the same amount of clothing that we would for a winter trip, because you could be sitting there in rain for days. And same with like rafting trips, you know, you'd be wearing your down puffy in the middle of nowhere in August, because that's just what Alaska did to you that day or that week. And so, yeah, having all that stuff. And, you know, I usually have people take a small roll of duct tape, take a tourniquet, take a space blanket, like one of those weather blankets,
yep,
and a lighter. And you've got basically anything. You can handle a lot of situations with that. So anyways, and a muslin bandage. Those are the things that I generally give people.
We're going to be like top wilderness rescue people.
Guaranteed.
You watch out for this bear. You just keep an eye out for us.
Well, the good news is I don't have to, because you're going to be taking care of yourselves. And that's the idea.
Exactly. Yeah. If we see you, it's probably a bad day.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, not anymore. I'm retired. So I'm 7 years away from that.
So we want to talk about what you're doing now.
Oh, gosh.
Because I looked at your website. And it's like terrifying for me to look at.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
But it's awesome. Yeah,
it is. Do you want to explain what you do now?
Sure. Yeah. So I took a couple of years off. I did a little bit of teaching, like operational medicine, for myself, and then I rolled into a very fun job. If it's your thing, I'm a helicopter ski guide up in Alaska for Chugach Powder Guides, which is this great company. I just wrapped up my third season up here. And it turns out I still really like flying on helicopters. I still really like being in the mountains. And skiing is, you know, one of my favorite things. And so I get to do all three of those things on a regular basis. And, you know, I went from seeing people on their worst day to generally people on some of their best days, you know, taking them big mountain skiing and powder. And it's just really, really, really fun. Yeah, it's a good time.
I got to send my husband up to you because he would
bring
die.
Him up. Yeah, bring him up. It's pretty fun.
So you take people in a helicopter, and then does the helicopter lands, right? You jump out and then you ski down. Is that how it goes? Okay.
Correct. Yeah. It is a helicopter chairlift, basically. So, you know, we get out at the top, they pick us up at the bottom, and then lather, rinse, repeat. We do it, you know, all day until they're tired or it's time to go home. And yeah, it's pretty fun. So it's been a good second career to launch into.
We're going to put a link to it in the description of this podcast just so people can check it out. And anybody can do it, right? It's open to the public,
yeah.
Correct?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. No, it's open to the general public. You know, it's really fun. There's a bunch of organizations that do it up in Alaska, but, you know, Chugach Powder Guides is where I work in Girdwood, which is just south of Anchorage by 45 minutes. Great company, great people. You know, it's fun to have the camaraderie again and be around a lot of motivated individuals who just want to do cool things and, you know, like working in a team environment and stuff.
Well, Bear, you deserve it for everything you've done. I mean,
we all deserve it. We really all deserve
it. Yeah.
There you go. Yes. So, I've only snowboarded 3 times.
Okay.
I'm from right outside of Lake Tahoe.
Oh, nice.
But I never grew up going skiing or snowboarding. I was a very active gymnast, so that took all my time. But we recently moved back, and so I'm like determined next season to try skiing or something. But the few times I went snowboarding, I would eat it off of the lift. That's how that's just how it was. So maybe I just need a helicopter is what you're saying.
There you go. Yeah. And repetition, right?
No, I just need a helicopter, Bear. That's all
we
I need.
We all need a helicopter. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty fun.
I haven't skied very much, but I am – I'm an excellent skier, even though I've only done it a few times.
Please.
No, it's one of those things I just picked up very naturally. As soon as I got on the skis, I got it. I got it. I used to go to the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah for like 8 years in a row. And it's just all the slopes are empty because nobody from the film industry skis.
Right.
And so it would just be me and my dad for hours just doing like all these runs. And I have some of my best memories. And just up there on the slopes. I'm not a big fan of the cold, but I like it. I mean, I'll enjoy it for a temporary.
Yeah, you know, just dress appropriately,
there.
Right?
Yeah, right. but yeah, I have such amazing fond memories of skiing. But when I see some of the pictures on the website, it's unbelievable. Like it's absolutely it's like a movie. It's like CGI. It doesn't even look real.
Right.
So it's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah,
like people do that for fun.
People do this for
Yeah, exactly.
Living
you know,
life.
And you stand up on this remote peak, and you look around on a beautiful, clear day, and there's just this sea of mountains around you, and it's breathtaking. It's really, really cool. And you know, if you're not into that, like I can't really help you because that's just fun. It's really, really fun. And you know, we take people on steeper stuff, but we also just take people on our whole goal is to put people on what they want and on the safest, best snow there is. And, you know, that's kind of how we think about it. I think about it. And that might not be the steepest line out there, because the conditions don't warrant that, or your ability doesn't warrant that, or your pleasure doesn't warrant that either. You just say, well, I just want big, wide open powder fields with that I don't want to worry about dying on. All right, check, we got you. That's easy. We can do that. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I love big, wide open groomers. You know, when people tell me that, I'm all about it. And I love the steep stuff too. But I think there's something out there for everyone if you get a chance to do it.
Yeah.
Now, how long is open season up there?
So good question. Generally from January, the middle of January until last week, we had our, you know, closing ceremony, our closing party, you know, last weekend. There's still a little bit of flying, but not much. And there's a little bit of flying before January, but not much. But our peak is generally March and April, February, March and April is generally the peak of it. So, yeah.
All right. So good Christmas gifts, everybody.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Come on up.
That'd be amazing.
And it's completely free, everybody.
Yeah, it's totally free.
Didn't hear that from me.
Use our promo code Bush and Banner.
Oh my God, no.
And Banner will give you a free.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's so funny. Jen, I got all my questions. Do you have anything else?
I mean, I could honestly talk to you all day. I have like a million, you know, you're just such a fascinating person, but we do so appreciate you being here. Is there anything you want to share with our listeners? We have a lot of outdoor adventure listeners.
Oh, gosh. I would say go out there and just try it all. Get out and do everything you think you want to do. And, you know, like it's a big world out there. There's millions of lifetimes of adventures of things to do. I'm trying to do a couple of lifetimes of things for adventure, and limited by time, but get out there and don't wait until, you know, next year to do something. The next best time to do it is tomorrow. You know?
Yes. That's our man right there, Diane.
Yeah.
That's what we're all about is, you know, it's so easy to just keep putting things off and to just wait till all the conditions or the scenario is right. Typically things will never be right. It's usually never the right time. There's always excuses. So we're all about just going out there and finding something you love and just trying to live life to the fullest.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I love that.
And don't forget your deck of cards.
Don't forget the deck of cards. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you guys have been on some very cool hikes and adventures as well. That's something I'm still hoping to get into and do more of. My 18-year-old has found the out of doors, my 20-year-old as well, but they're all wanting to do adventures. And so it's fun when they ask you to go on adventures and take them on, you know, trips. So that's what we're doing.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I have so much respect for you and everyone else who does what you do. Thank you so much for serving you know, our country and the people and, you know, letting us feel safe going out there, even if we make stupid mistakes sometimes.
Thank you. We all make stupid mistakes. Yeah. We all deserve it. We all deserve the service. So yeah. Thank you so much
for your time, Bear. Yeah. And I hope to catch up with you. Maybe I'll see you on some mountains sometime. Hopefully I'm on 2 feet. I'm not tumbling down.
That's
my hope.
I'll film you, Jen.
All right. Bye, Bear. Have a great one. Have fun skiing.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.